Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
Well, and happy day after Labor Day. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Diana West is on the line with us. She's the author of a new book, The Death of the Grown-Up, How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization. Many of her columns you'll find over at townhall.com, William F. Buckley's site, if I remember right. Is that right, Diana?
William F. Buckley was what? I'm sorry, Tom?
He was the founder of Town Hall?
No, I don't believe so. He founded National Review. I don't know who founded Town Hall.
Ah, okay. I had it wrong. I thought that he had been involved in starting that. I've always been a fan of William F. Buckley. So, in any case, you also write for the Washington Times, and in fact, I guess that's your day job. And
well, actually, I'm a syndicated columnist. Washington Times is my home paper, but I'm in about 100 papers across the country.
Great. Great. Give us the premise of your book. I spent several hours with the book, and I particularly liked your quotes from de Tocqueville. In fact, I used that the de Tocqueville quote. Actually, I used about 12 paragraphs of it rather than just one in one of my books, Unequal Protection. And this is something that he was seeing. Rather than my talking, give us the premise of your book.
Sure. The premise of the book has to do with the transfer of cultural authority from adults to young people, teenagers, that started taking place most noticeably after World War II. And what my premise is that this does not just merely affect superficial, more or less fleeting pop cultural phenomena like bad hair, dopey music, silly movies, etc., that this has actually changed the way we behave, our goals of behavior, and that basically we have as a culture adopted a rather immature model. And it's all very well in peacetime to sort of have these kinds of pursuits and kind of turning away from more mature aspirations, but now that we are actually in a very hot war, not just a culture war, these things seem to be showing up in a dangerous way in the ways we talk about our foes, the way we deal with trying to defend ourselves.
Yeah, I'm not even sure it's a good thing in peacetime. I spent a large portion of my career over the last many decades in the advertising business. And as in a variety of positions, including CEO of a fairly large ad agency. And the major goal of corporate advertising is to infantilize people, mm-hmm. is to whisper into the ear of people, you are the most important person in the world. I mean, that really is. That's ultimately it. Yeah. And in looking through your book, I noticed that, you know, you excoriate liberals and you talk about, you know, the culture and all these kinds of things.
I excoriate conservatives. My book is a bit different from a lot of, I'm a conservative, but my book, I do not feel, has a place on the spectrum because I've seen these same immature failings in conservatives.
Well, maybe I missed it then because
you didn't read through the book, clearly.
I probably read a third of all the words in your book, which is actually pretty rare for anybody who's doing an interview on the radio.
Oh, I'm flattered. But no, actually, my case study in terms of applying my theory to the real world does go up to and go right into the rhetoric and behavior of George Bush. So and the White House and the conservatives who support him. So I would not say this is an excoriation of liberals alone. I think we're all creatures of our time.
I agree, but I was in mid sentence there. I didn't see and again correct me if I'm wrong. I didn't see anywhere in the book where the two things that jumped out at me were number one, you stated in the book that one of the reasons why this rose, in particular in the 60s, was a consequence of the affluence of the 60s, mm-hmm. the middle class affluence of the 60s.
Yes.
And secondly, I didn't see a good clear breakdown of the role of the rise of power of corporations. In 1918, public relations was invented. You know, Woodrow Wilson helped invent the public relations industry to sell us on World War I. And in the 1950s, modern advertising, particularly in the mid-50s, as psychological mm-hmm. techniques started coming into advertising, were invented. And it seems to me that these things, the role of public relations and advertising and the enormous power that corporations have taken over our culture,
mm-hmm.
is really the driving force. And so two questions. One, if you think that it was affluence in the 60s, should we simply reduce everybody to the working poor? Is that the solution?
Well,
and number two, why not talk about the role of corporations in all this?
Well, again, I'm going to have to refer you back to my book because I think one of the major developments was the development of the youth market. This was a huge change. There had never been, the word teenager doesn't come into our lexicon until about 1941.
Yep.
And after World War II, with the rise of influence and with the changeovers in industry, we see the first rise of a youth market. And that, I do go into that. I hope you have a chance to take a look at that because I think that was incredibly important because it showed the power of the youth. All of a sudden, instead of young people contributing, say, to the family kitty during the Depression years, you had, if young people were working, they were pocketing their money, or they were even getting an allowance. And what did they do with that allowance? They spent it. They spent it on princess phones, on new clothes. There were young miss sections suddenly appeared in department stores where they didn't exist before. Of course, the biggest change was the rise of the youth entertainment market, namely rock and roll. That was wholly a phenomenon of young people having money. And I think that that does speak to your concern about corporate America in terms of what they were doing with the corporations and businesses in the years after the war.
Right, but, okay. Also in the book, in your chapter, the Real Culture War, you say, you're talking about Sharia states, and these injustices, the Sharia states, you write, are of course wholly irreconcilable with the provisions of universal human rights. And you talk about how in 89, Ayatollah Khomeini issued a fatwa against Salman Rushdie.
Mm-hmm.
And you write with some concern about the possibility of Islamic Sharia states, you know, sweeping across Europe as to some extent they are actually, and across the United States as being a real problem.
Mm-hmm.
How does an authoritarian Muslim state differ from an authoritarian Christian state?
Well, I don't know any authoritarian Christian states, but an authoritarian Muslim state is an anti-liberty state. What we have developed in the Western world through very arduous, blood-soaked, difficult centuries has been a culture that prizes the individual, freedom of conscience, freedom of the individual, and so they are wholly antithetical. A lot of these ideas developed out of Christianity and of Judaism, of course.
Well, there's a real effort to create them.
I'm sorry?
I was going to say there's a real effort to create an authoritarian Christian state. Tim Faye thought of blowing up the Oklahoma.
I'm assuming you're familiar with the history of the Massachusetts colony? Excuse me?
Are you familiar with the history of Massachusetts in the early years?
Yes, of course.
I mean, it was an authoritarian Christian state. Women were burned at the stake for being witches.
I think we've moved on, as we used to say in the Clinton years. I think we have evolved, and I think that is not the kind of world that I am trying to uphold, obviously, and it's not the kind of world that exists today. And that's
I agree with you. But my point is that there are people within our society who want to take us back to that state. That's what Tim McVeigh was trying to do when he blew up the Oklahoma City building.
Tim McVeigh is dead, and I do not feel any threat as a female from the Christian authoritative state devotees you may have in mind. That's not at all what we're talking about. We're talking about a world where it has a Western world that is based on freedom of the press, that is based
on. So you're not concerned about General Blinken saying, "My God is bigger than your God, and we're going to go over."
No, I'm not. I do not have a problem with that. I'm not concerned about it. It doesn't threaten me or you. It has a lot to do with religious doctrinal differences that, I'm sorry, do exist between Christianity and Islam, and followers of Christianity are naturally steeped in such a belief. Out of Christianity, we gain a lot of the more or less, which have become secular, freedoms that we enjoy today, and which our cultures, as post-Christian, I would call them cultures, actually do uphold.
And many Muslim states now are rejecting Sharia law. This is what the president was talking about this weekend in Anbar State. How the Sunnis in the Anbar State are saying, no, we do not want Al Qaeda, which is a Sharia state.
Yes, you're right. I don't agree with the president's whole understanding and outlook on Islam. I think he's done a lot of damage to our own efforts to learn about Islam and the world in struggle at this point. But certainly, what you're looking at in Anbar is more or less differences between different, if you will, mafia warring tribes, different competing visions of Islam. But it's not; it doesn't mean a rejection of Sharia.
Well, we'll have to leave it at that. Diana West, the book, The Death of the Grown-Up, How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization, townhall.com for more of Diana's writing. Diana, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio. Stephanie Miller, Tom Hartman, Randy Rhodes, Jeff Farias, and Mike Malloy. Weekdays on 1480 KPHX.
I got just one life in a world that keeps on pushing me around. But I stand my ground and I won't back down.
21 minutes past the hour. By the way, on Friday, we did have a winner in our, or David did pick a blog from the blogging over at AirAmerica.com to send a free autographed copy of Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, my new book out too. And it was titled More Shiny Keys, and OCN Storms is the winner. He says, I hope the rest of the world knows how controlled the mainstream media is in this country. Shiny, shiny, oh, pretty, blah. And it was a good post. So I didn't announce it on the air. It was C-SPAN Day last Friday, and we were nuts. I don't know how to describe beyond that. We were absolutely nuts. I'd like to take this discussion that we started with Diana West to the larger picture. Her book, blurbed by Michelle Malkin and Tony Blankley and Robert Bork, probably gives you a sense of the direction of it, and it's actually an interesting read. But I would take it a huge step beyond that. And the point that I was trying to make is that I agree with her that America's arrested development is destructive. I don't agree that it came about as the consequence of prosperity in the 60s. Because the obvious conclusion of that is do away with prosperity, which is, by the way, exactly what Mr. Qutb, who was the guy who was living in, as I recall, in St. Louis in the 1950s, and many of the founders of the neoconservatives. They were looking at the 60s and going, holy cow, this is a society melting down. Look at this. Women are burning bras and men are saying, young men are saying, no, they're hell no, we won't go to a war. And people were, getting high, and African Americans were asking for equality. And I mean, this is a society going, melting down. So Mr. Strauss, Professor Strauss at the University of Chicago, the founder of the neoconservative movement, Mr. Qutb, who went back to Egypt and founded the Muslim Brotherhood, which then was, when he was executed, was taken over by Mr. al-Zawahiri, who moved to Afghanistan and then took on as his disciple Osama bin Laden, and it became al-Qaeda. The neoconservative movement and al-Qaeda both emerged out of, and Adam Curtis did a brilliant four-hour documentary on this for the BBC called The Power of Nightmares, which you can Google and you can watch online. And both of these movements, the Al-Qaeda movement, which was an attempt to grow up Islam, to make Islam more authoritarian, and the neoconservative movement, which even though it was started by largely a small group of largely Jewish folks, decided to use, and Leo Strauss writes about this, talks about this just right up front. Christianity was the dominant religion in the United States, so let's use Christianity to promote this, to create an authoritarian state in the United States and around the world, ultimately. And they both saw this as a way of maturing society, because they saw freedom as being immature. I mean, this is the argument that was used against Thomas Jefferson, was that the American Revolution was an immature act. It was essentially anti-conservative. It was way too liberal. What? Independence from England? What, you guys think you can run your own country? Come on, give me a break. And so you had like Sir Edmund Burke, you know, writing about how dangerous this is. But I would take it a step beyond that, and I would say, yes, there is vast immaturity in this country. And it is working to the benefit of major corporate powers in this country. And again, as Diana West points out in her book, although she and I draw different conclusions from it, a lot of this began with the rise of corporate power in the 30s, 40s, 50s. And the public relations industry going back to World War I. She doesn't mention that in the book as far as I know, but it's, and so here now we have, for example, ignoring the environment. I consider this a childish, selfish thing. For the conservatives to go, oh, well, you know, global warming, who cares? We're not going to worry about future generations. That's incredibly childish. Ignoring community is childish. Adults are concerned about community. I mean, raising children, Louise and I raised three children. What reward do you get from that? I mean, there's no economic, well, in some societies, you know, your kids care for you, but not in ours. Altruism, caring for family, caring for community. This is adult stuff. And the childish aspect of it to say, oh, we shouldn't have national health care, we shouldn't have minimum wage, we shouldn't do those things which make a community strong. That is, in my mind, ultimately childish. I see what is represented today as the conservative worldview as the ultimate infantile, childish worldview. It's totally focused on self. In the run-up to the Iraq War, we heard no serious voices warning about what was going to happen, what actually did happen, the disaster of Iraq. Why? Infantilism of the United States by corporate media, who also happen to own businesses that profit from the war. The Moonies, the people who own Washington Times, you know, it's, I mean, talk about infantilized. Reverend Moon tells people who to marry. And then when they have sex, you have to have a picture of Reverend Moon sitting watching you all the time. I mean, so it's time for us to grow up. I really think it's time for us to grow up. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Life's like a road that you travel on. There's one day here and the next day gone. Sometimes you bend, sometimes you stand. Sometimes you turn your back to the wind. There's a world outside every darkened door where blues won't haunt you anymore. Where the brave are free and lovers soar. Come ride with me to the distant shore. We won't hesitate to break down the garden gate. There's not much time left today.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. And, yes, strange things out there. A new Santa Barbara City art project is being called a thoughtless waste of money. Some say it'll even lower property values. But it is thought-provoking. The project called the Light Blue Line is intended to show the potential consequences of global warming. Volunteers will be painting a series of light blue waves down the middle of 68 city streets this fall to demonstrate the impact of a 7-meter rise in sea level. Supporters say its purpose is to raise public awareness about climate change. The project is approved, and its $12,000 price tag is being offset by private donations. But opponents say it may lower property values for those on the wrong side of the line. On the other hand, it might raise property values for people on the right side of the line. Here you've got a house that's 15 blocks inland. You've now got this blue line going down the street in front of your house, and you can put it for sale as future beachfront property. Right? I mean, how cool does it get? Bhutan. Bhutan has a gross national happiness instead of gross national product. Tucked away, this from the our Sunday newspaper, the Oregonian. Kate Linkthicum writing in the Oregonian. Tucked high in the Himalayas between China and India, Bhutan is home to a branch of Buddhism that values community over individualism. Education and health care are free for all citizens. And in the 2 months I spent studying there, I didn't encounter a single homeless person. Bhutan does things differently. Its leaders, long leery of the modern world and its globalized market culture, have adopted a unique approach to development called gross national happiness. Instead of measuring GDP, they measure GNH. They really and truly do. 1-866-303-2270 is our telephone number, toll-free nationwide. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartmann.com, and just up at the top of the page, click live chat. If you'd like to participate in our blog, our message boards are over at tomhartmann.com as well. Our blog is at airamerica.com, and you can drop in there and say hi as well. Ralph in Durham, North Carolina. Hey, Ralph, welcome to the program.
Yeah. Hello, Tom. How are you doing today?
I'm just great, but I'll get better. What's up, Ralph?
I've talked to you a few times. I'm not an old farmer. They couldn't kick off the farm back there in the 80s.
Hey, good on you.
Yeah, remember, I talked to you a couple, three times.
Yep.
The problem with that lady you got, they think they're conservatives or in their viewpoint. But the problem is capitalism, and if you really look at reality, like you said before, it's where you invest money to make money for doing nothing.
Yeah, ultimately.
So in reality, what it really is a fancy word for usury.
Well, yeah, usury is charging interest over an acceptable amount, or in some religions, any amount. But
well, that's where the problem in our economy, and that's how all this stuff is springing from.
Yeah, I would say that a lot of
interest shouldn't be over 1%. It ought to be 0.5% on savings, and you probably ought to have 20% to buy a house. I don't believe people would be in trouble.
And then right. And
their money would hold value. Inflation is just devaluating the currency.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Ralph. And in fact, that's how it used to be. It used to be that these things were regulated. Do you know, for example, let me just finish that thought, actually, before I go to the next. It used to be that by law, the regulatory agencies said to the banks, people have to have a certain percentage of a down payment in order to buy a house. They have to have a certain asset to a debt ratio. The cost of the monthly payments cannot exceed a certain percentage of their income. I mean, all this stuff, this wasn't just conventions in the banking industry. This used to be the rules. And then, of course, came deregulation. Similarly, back before 1978, the National Institutes of Mental Health, or National Institutes of Health, NIH, with your and my tax dollars, developed the majority of new drugs. They still do. Most new drugs are developed by research that is paid for by you and me with our tax dollars through National Institutes of Health in collaboration with universities and with pharmaceutical companies. Before 1978, when those drugs were developed, a portion of the proceeds from the sale of the drugs had to go back to NIH to pay for more research. But after 1978, they got the rules changed. So now the drug companies get to keep all of the money, and you and I pay for all of the research. What's wrong with this picture? KJ in Camas, Washington. Hey, KJ.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to comment on your first guest. You and she made some really good points about the innate immaturity of our culture, but I would remind you that children have a lot of admirable qualities, or I should say maybe they lack some, like racism, homophobia. These are all learned attitudes, and I just like to sign off by quoting the rabbi of Nazareth, who said, unless you become like little children, you cannot enter the kingdom of God. As a pagan, I interpret that to mean, if we don't adopt some of the ways of little children before we tend to spoil them, I mean, if we were to adopt those and become more childlike, we could have heaven right here on earth, here and now.
Yeah. Interesting point, KJ, and well said. Scott, thank you. Scott in Richmond, Virginia. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
If I could get one thought into voters' minds in the upcoming presidential election, I would have them consider the three biggest financial disasters to hit the United States and affect everyday people, that being the savings and loan, Enron and all the other companies that forfeited pensions, and now the subprime mortgage debacle, all are the direct result of Republican deregulation policies.
Yeah, and the same is true, by the way, of the Great Depression of 1929.
Well, I wasn't even going to stretch people's imagination that far, but how can I would dare any Republican to show me any tax hike proposed by a Democrat that did the damage of the policies of the Republican Party over the years.
Oh, yeah. And I don't know if you saw Doonesbury over the weekend in the Sunday Funnies, but, he pointed out that three presidents, two Bushes and a Reagan, have run up 70% of all the debt in the history of the United States.
It's all about making supporters rich and until they get caught.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well said, Scott. And these three presidents running up 70% of all the debt in the history of the United States, and then they spend that money and they pass the debt down to our children and grandchildren, the ultimately immature behavior. And in the course of spending all that money, they stimulate the economy and they say, hey, look at how good things are. Well, you know, you give me a credit card with a $5 million line of credit on it or a $10 million line of credit on it that I'll never have to pay, and I'll show you what it looks like to live large. That doesn't mean it's real. Patricia in Sacramento, California. Hey, Patricia.
Hey, Tom. Tom, I wanted to talk about Benjamin Barber. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's the author of the book Consumed. I haven't actually read his book, but he was on C-SPAN yesterday, and it was, you know, one of the book events where he describes what his book is about. And I think it touches on what you were just talking about earlier. But he says that as consumers, you know how we make private decisions on what we want to buy, whether BMW or Armani clothes. But what he says is that we no longer make decisions that benefit the community as a whole, meaning when we buy. For example, he's saying we don't make the connection when we buy a gas guzzler. We don't see our son and daughter in the future going into Iran and protecting oil because of that. You know, we're not making collective decisions anymore that benefit us as a whole, as a state or as a country.
Right, and we once did.
Exactly. And the last point I want to make, Tom, is that I think this touches on what you were just ending on there, is he talks about the market economy and the market and the state, and he's saying that in order to have a democracy, you have to have a balance of both. And, you know, you have the market economy that creates inventions, new technologies, creates production based on demand and supply, which is a fantastic thing. But the state has to be there to protect the public. That's why you have institutions like the EPA, the FDA. You have the courts that interpret the law. So he's saying that you do not have a democracy if you have too much control of the market or too much control of the state. So there has to be a balance.
Right. And what we've shifted toward, a good point, Patricia. Thank you very much for making it. And what we've shifted toward is a situation where the marketplace is viewed as the ultimate arbiter of everything. This really began back in the 1960s and 1970s with the rise in the United States, although actually it came out of the Montpellier, I believe is how it's pronounced. Somebody might want to correct me on this society. Oh, speaking of correction, several people called to say that in Massachusetts they were not burning witches, they were hanging them. You're absolutely right. In fact, the last witch to be hanged in Massachusetts was a woman named Mary. I forget her last name now, but... And it was right around the time Ben Franklin was either born or a young child. But in any case, that the Montpellier Society got together, and these guys, which led to a whole series of think tanks, the Heritage Foundation, corporate funding, Lewis Powell's famous memo to the American Chamber of Commerce, the coming together of business in the United States to say, okay, that's it. We're going to change the way Americans think. And we're going to stop having a consensus in the United States that we're all in this together and that government somehow is part of all of us. And we're going to start creating a consensus in the United States that is what is referred to by Europeans as neoliberalism. I'm reluctant to use that word. I think probably Reaganism is a better word. It's the ultimate neoliberalism. That ultimately the individual is the most important thing. And this is, again, another form of infantilism, another form of regressing people back to childhood for all practical purposes. And what is the net effect of it? What's the net consequence of it? It allows the wealthy elites, the powerful elites, corporate and inherited wealth, to concentrate more and more political power and wealth. That's the bottom line. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
The America, my daddy used to know, where right was right and not political code, where leaders in D.C. still respected you and me. The America my daddy taught to me.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. You recall, those of you who are regular listeners, a couple of weeks ago when I was in New York City, My best friend of 30 years, Jerry Schneiderman, dropped by. He said hi on the show. We were talking about Jerry's how he managed to get his phone listed as Izzy Unlisted. Jerry is the master of the practical joke. He has been getting for years now, as probably all of us have. I remember back in the 70s, you know, running a business in Michigan, getting them in the mail. Now they come in email. These messages from Nigeria saying, you know, that I'm related to the vice admiral of the country, and we've got $40 million, and we're trying to sneak it out of the country, and we'll gladly give you 10% of it if you'll just help us. All you have to do is give us your checking account number, and we'll put the money in, and then, of course, they take all the money out of your checking account. So Jerry's been keeping the email addresses and the names of all these people in Nigeria who have been sending him these solicitations, and so he's got a letter that he's sending out to them. It's brilliant. He says, "Dear sir, I'm writing to you in desperation from the United States, hoping you can save my family's wealth from seizure by our oppressive government, which has just enacted new laws allowing them to seize the assets of all those it considers enemies of their administration. My brave and honorable father, a successful real estate investor, is one such person who refuses to be silenced in his criticism of our president, Mr. George Bush. Our family now fears for our father and hopes to save our family assets by forming a business partnership with an honorable person from outside our country and transferring approximately $50 million offshore. Based on emails we have received from you in Nigeria, we have learned that you are an astute investor of high morality, integrity, and a long career of helping others in their financial times of need. Out of respect for your financial acumen, we are offering an administrative fee of 10% for your services if you can open a bank account in your homeland and help us move these funds from our besieged land over there to yours. If you are currently too busy to handle this investment, I look forward to any other suggestion of another party of equal integrity who might benefit from our crisis. I look forward to hearing from you shortly. Respectfully, Jerry Schneiderman." God bless you, Jerry. Oh, my. Ed in Little Rock, Arkansas. Hey, Ed, welcome to the program.
Actually, it's not Ed, it's David.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hey, David.
I'll take what I can get. Hey, I really enjoy your show, Tom, and I've been preaching for a long time what you were just talking about a minute ago as far as how did we come to be brought to think in such a sheep-like way. You know, we all think that corporate profits are so incredibly important. That we've got people like working for insurance companies now who are perfectly willing to deny claims of hardworking, you know, middle class people who have a legitimate insurance claim or whatever.
That's their job is to deny those claims. The reality that we used to understand, that we understood for 230 years in this country, David, was that there are at least three equal and important things. There is the economy. There is, you know, business and the economy. That's there and it's real and it's important. The ability to make things and do things, number one. Number two, there's the commons. There's the stuff that we all collectively own in common, which includes government and community. And number three, there's family and community. And family and community have been discarded and subsumed, I would say, to a large extent in this neoliberal, let's call it Reaganism, in the Reaganism world. It's, you know, I got mine, that kind of thing, number one. And number two, the commons, you know, we always at some level understood that part of the commons was things like pure water and pure air. But now, you know, the commons is the survival of the human race. I mean, go see Leonardo DiCaprio's movie, The 11th Hour. It's really Al Gore, in fact, sent out a letter to everybody on his mailing list last week encouraging them to go see Leo DiCaprio's new movie, The 11th Hour. And what the neoliberals and neoconservatives and all these new, right, all these guys, what they are promoting, what the Reaganism, what Reagan has been promoting with his...
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help."
What he's promoting is a hatred of the commons including the government as part of the commons.
Right.
And ultimately a dismissal of even community, family, neighborhood, you know, all that kind of thing, and just, you know, just dismissing the whole thing and saying that the only thing that's important is the economy, and not even the economy's impact on the average person. I thought it was really interesting in the Sunday paper, and I don't recall if it was the New York Times or if it was our local paper, the Oregonian. I think it was the local paper. There was on Labor Day yesterday, there was one op-ed piece from a guy pointing out how wages have not gone up since Reagan became president. Unionization has gone down, benefits have gone down, the middle class is being wiped out. And then on the other side, there was one talking about how the economy has grown, productivity has increased, stockholder wealth has grown. It didn't point out that, you know, the wealth at the very top has grown. But the point is that the average guy is getting screwed, and the top 1%, the top 0.1% are doing very, very well, thank you very much. And for some reason, the only thing that the press talks about is that top, that very, you know, little bit at the very top, and thus the disaster. Dave in Olympia, Washington, we've only got about 30 seconds before we have to wrap up this hour of the show. Dave, what's up?
Okay, yeah, this is Dave. I was going to talk about unions as well and what's happening at the Mexican border where the truckers are being allowed, or that George Bush wants to allow the truckers to come across without being trained and with.
I think it starts this week. I think it starts this week, doesn't it?
Yes. It's a pilot program. But it's a good example of how what's set up is having people who don't know any better take jobs for less from people who should know better.
Well, and ultimately it goes even beyond that, Dave. What it has to do with is increasing the profits for the trucking companies. And to hell with people driving on the roads who might be facing unsafe trucks or high emissions, you know, the environment, or the American worker. I mean, you know, what, kidding? 57 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from Thomas Jefferson: every generation needs a new revolution. Rich Galen is with us. He's the senior advisor to the Fred Thompson campaign. Also has a very thought-provoking blog. You can find a link to it over at his website, Mullings.com. Mullings as in ponderings, M-U-L-L-I-N-G-S, or maybe as what you do to cider. Hey, Rich.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine. Great to have you with us. Fred Thompson, this week, going to announce that he's running for president. Is that right?
We're strapping it on, getting ready to go.
Now, I understand that by doing it, by waiting until Thursday, he's able to move the disclosure date out to the point where he won't have to disclose who his financial contributors were until after some of the first primaries have been held. Is that right?
Yeah, well, that is not true. Of course, we have to file at the end of the quarter like everybody else. But my advice was to wait until about a half an hour before the swearing-in ceremony on January 20th, 2009, announce then, have a little party, and then take the oath of office. But I was overruled.
Let's just skip the election part, go right
exactly
to the
right.
Supreme Court like George Bush did.
We said this is going to be a non-traditional campaign, and we're not kidding.
Yeah, yeah. All you need, unfortunately, Rehnquist is dead, but
I know.
All you need is the Supreme Court on your side.
We still got 5-4. We can do it.
There you go. Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah.
Let's talk about a few issues here.
Sure.
I'm curious. We're talking with Rich Galen. He's a senior advisor to the Fred Thompson campaign. A senior advisor or the senior advisor?
Right now, I'm the senior advisor. That doesn't mean there won't be other senior advisors.
Right.
But in Washington, there's only senior advisors. There's no such thing as a regular advisor, much less
right.
a junior advisor. So the senior is a little superfluous.
There we go. Okay. So does Fred Thompson believe health care is a right or a privilege?
I think, no, I have no idea whether he thinks it's a right or a privilege. What I do think is that he believes very strongly that health care should be made available for everybody who wants it, as opposed to making sure that everybody has to have it, whether they want it or not.
You mean there are some people who might not want it?
Sure, of course. There's a lot of people who don't want it.
Well, there are people who don't want to pay for health care, but if somebody breaks their leg,
we're not talking about health care. We're talking about health care insurance.
No, I'm not talking about health care insurance. I'm talking about health care.
Everybody wants health care, but somebody's got to pay
right.
for it.
So the question is, healthcare a right or a privilege?
It's a right by law in the vast majority
of industrialized societies.
I don't know. I just don't know. I've never raised that in those terms.
You might want to ask him.
Hang on a second. I'll get him on the other line. Go to a break, and I'll have the answer when you. No, I'm only kidding.
Okay, all right. Well, feel free. Does Fred Thompson believe that if you play by the rules and work a 40-hour week, you should be able to be part of the middle class?
I think he believes. Listen, here's something about Fred that really, without kidding or anything else, that he takes very seriously. I know you've read this, but he really did start out as a very poor guy in God knows where, Tennessee, and worked his way through two colleges and then got a scholarship to law school. But he understands what happens when you have to mop the floors to pay for school. Why you've got a baby at home. I mean,
there's a big difference. And let me just draw that very clearly. My wife Louise worked her way through college as a waitress in a Howard Johnson's. I worked my way through college working, although I didn't complete it, working as a DJ for essentially minimum wage.
How'd that work out?
$65 an hour.
It
worked out fine. But the fact of the matter is that it we're in a different world now. The rules have been changed. Reagan came in and changed the rules so dramatically, and over the last 26 years, the rules have been changed so dramatically that you cannot work your way through college with a minimum wage job any longer. It's impossible. So the world that Fred Thompson is holding up as saying this is how it should be, that's not how it is. And the only way to go back to that is
how do you even know what world he's holding up?
Well,
why would you say the world that Fred Thompson
the example that you just gave
that way?
The example that you just held up of how Fred bootstrapped himself, I'm saying is not possible any longer.
An example of a guy who's in his 60s and the fact that he made, as did an awful lot of people, not your generation because you're a generation beyond me, but in your generation as well. I mean, your story is just as valid, absolutely as valid. And people still work their way through college. They have college loans. They have grants. I mean, every single college. I mean, I worked at a small college in Ohio, and that was a major part of what happened every summer is working out the grant and aid packages so kids could come. And
so, Rich, back to the question, though. Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican president,
Wait a minute. You're not allowed to go back 20 years, but you're allowed to go back 100. I get it.
I said you couldn't go back 20 years?
Yeah, you said it's a different world.
It is.
Go back 100 years.
And it's a different world than it was when Teddy Roosevelt was president, too.
Okay.
Teddy Roosevelt came out with what he proposed. He called it the Square Deal. And he said that if you work, it was a 50-hour week back then. He said if you work a 50-hour week and you play by the rules, you should be able to have your family's health covered. Never worry about health, about sickness. That you should be able to take a vacation of at least 2 weeks every year. That you should be able to provide for education for your children, including college, and that your retirement should be secure.
I'm not doubting your word about any of this, but the world.
I'll play the clip
for
you.
Hang on a second. The world in the early 1900s was, as you say, so shockingly different that it stuns me. And I'll look it up, but it stuns me to hear you say that Teddy Roosevelt said that people should get to go to college. Nobody went to college then. I mean, that just doesn't sound right to me.
Yeah, no, he said to provide for the education of your children. I mean,
Well, he didn't say college, though. We do. We do provide for the education of our children.
Okay.
We have state colleges. I mean, we have a lot of. I mean, anybody.
I'm back to this issue of a living wage. Here's Teddy Roosevelt.
There are people in the country who, for reasons beyond their control, want to get a college education and can't. But they are in the distinct minority. College has become available to every single person who is qualified and wants to go.
Yeah, but back to the original question. Teddy Roosevelt said.
Include enough to secure the elements of a normal standard of living.
I can't hear what that
standard is. Standard high enough to make morality possible.
A standard of living high enough to make morality possible.
To
provide for education and recreation.
To care for immature members of the family.
To care for immature members of the family.
To maintain the family during periods of sickness.
To maintain the family during periods of sickness.
And to permit a reasonable saving for old age.
And to permit a reasonable savings for old age. Now, the fact of the matter is that right now, a person living on the minimum wage cannot do any of those things.
Very few people.
Does Fred Thompson believe that? Pardon?
Look, I mean, you find me. I mean, that's just silly, Tom. That's a ridiculous statement.
What is?
Even for you.
What is?
that living on the minimum wage can't do any of those things. People living on the minimum wage can do virtually all of those things.
People living on the minimum wage cannot afford health insurance. I'm sorry.
Well,
you can't pay $10,000 a year for health insurance when you are earning $13,000 a year.
The minimum wage person probably can't qualify for the level of health insurance that you and your wife have. True.
For the level of health insurance that would be necessary if you get a serious illness to avoid bankruptcy.
I'm not an expert on health insurance premiums other than my own, which is really high because I have had bypass surgery. I watch the ads all the time the same as you do. Health insurance is available not to everybody, but you can't run an entire society based upon a very small minority. What you have to do is run an entire society based upon what you the highest and best attributes of most of the people. The people that are at the absolute bottom of any society, and it doesn't matter which one it is, it doesn't matter whether it's Charles Dickens' time or our time, we have to have other organizations help them out, whether it's eleemosynary organizations, whether it's...
Other than government.
And government, to the extent that, I mean, that's how you get to minimum wage. The government demands it. I don't have any problem with that.
So does Fred Thompson support increasing the minimum wage to a livable wage?
No, we just did it.
So you think it's fine where it is?
We only have a minute left to your issue. It's going to be raised every what? 2 weeks? 3 weeks? What?
I think it should be raised right now to a living wage.
What would be a living wage?
Well, here in Vermont, I think it's here in Oregon rather, I think it's around $12 an hour. Does Fred Thompson think that we should have a Manhattan Project style commitment to get off oil?
He's not far from that. I don't know that he's put it in those terms, but he does believe very seriously that not just get off oil, but not to walk into a problem where you trade oil for yet another problem, which is to be wholly dependent on like ethanol, because not being able to grow food. Going back to your point, and a valid one at that, is that the old no free lunch. As you know, ethanol, corn prices have gone through the ceiling, which means that beef and pork prices have gone up. Those are staples of everybody's diets, including poor people, and it's putting a huge strain on the lower edges of the economy.
But there's 100 other ways to produce power than that.
Okay.
All right, well, we'll continue this conversation in the future. Rich Galen, he's the senior advisor to the Fred Thompson campaign, Mullings.com, MULLINGS.com, his website. Rich, thanks for being with us today.
Be well, my friend.
You too. Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Wanna shout out? Shout out.
Past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Time for our I Know Something alert for the day.
I know nothing, I see nothing, and I say nothing.
No. This is the I Know Something. This week's Science News. The weekly news magazine of science, which I have subscribed to for, I think, better than 20 years. This is a fascinating story. Since 1979... a mysterious epidemic has been afflicting house cats. It's called feline hyperthyroidism, and it's usually characterized by weight loss, hyperactivity, and eventual heart disease, and it's now the leading hormonal disorder in cats. So since 79, they've been trying to figure out, which is what, 28 years now? If I'm doing my math right? For 28 years, they've been trying to figure out why is it that house cats are going down in flames with us. Looking back on this, we had a cat that I think died of feline hyperthyroidism. She was also very old. She was like 17 years old, but all of a sudden she just got whacked. And now they're figuring this new study that was just published in Environmental Science and Technology. They tested blood samples from 23 cats, including 11 with hyperthyroidism, and what they found was that the cats with hyperthyroidism had much higher levels of a chemical called PBDE, polybromated diphenyl esters, or ethers, polybromated diphenyl ethers. Now, what the hell are PBDEs? Well, they're the flame retardants that were mandated in 1979 to put into carpets and furniture and children's clothing and things like that. And it looks like, according, and this is just epidemiological studies, that these PBDEs are what's causing the thyroids in these cats to go nuts and kill the cats. And then they also say tests of 20 types of dry and wet cat food showed that all contained PBDEs, although canned fish-flavored food had the highest amounts and could deliver 12 times as much of the chemicals as dry foods typically did. The canned fish-flavored foods also had concentrations of PBDEs that were 100 times as high as those in the human diet. The co-author of the study, who also works for the EPA, Linda Birnbaum, says it sure as heck looked like there's something going on here. Our data begged for additional studies. Which also leads me to wonder, and speculate out loud, the most widely prescribed prescription drug in the United States right now is Synthroid, which is an artificial hormone for the thyroid. And there is an absolute epidemic in the United States and has been for the better part of 30 years. And see, again, here we this starting in 79 was when, you know, this happened. Has been this explosion in hypothyroidism, in ultimately the failure of the thyroid, in largely in women in the United States. And in house cats. Only the house cats are getting hyperthyroidism. And I think it would be fascinating. I don't know if there's any epidemiologists out there or scientists listening to this program, but it would be a fascinating study to find, you know, 500, 1,000, 5,000, whatever you could find, people who have experience within the previous 40 years, 30 or 40 years, have experienced hyperthyroidism or hypothyroidism and have had to go on either in the case of one person I know, actually had to have essentially chemical surgery, had to take a drug that killed off part of his thyroid to take him from hyperthyroidism down to normal, and other people I know who are taking Synthroid or Armour or other forms of thyroid hormones to raise the function or to imitate the function of a dead thyroid or a non-functioning thyroid to find out if it happened within, say, 6 months of getting their house, you know, wall-to-wall carpet covered throughout their house, or bringing new furniture into their house. I think this would be a fascinating epidemiological study, and you know, pretty much it's looking like, you know, it's house cats are the canaries in the coal mine. I mean, once again, we find that in nature we're seeing the early warning signals. The absolute early warning signals saying, hey, wait a minute, guys. Maybe this is... And they point out these polybrominated diphenyl ethers, they show up in water, in fish, in house dust, in human foods, and people. In fact, the way they think the cats get it is you put the new carpet in the house or you put the new furniture in the house and it's got these PBDEs, these flame retardants in it. They shed as dust... The cats pick the dust up on their hair, and then they lick themselves, and that's how it gets into the cats, because cats are so clean. Well, you know, arguably cats are actually covered with cat spit, but nonetheless, the theory is cats are so clean that they get an enormous amount of this stuff inside their bodies. Interesting stuff. Anyhow, we'll be back with your calls. 27 minutes past the hour, and more news.
It just don't get any better. That's about as good ever gets. If there's anything better, it's something I miss. It just don't get any better than this.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, there's just a lot going on in the world. Let me just give you a quick recap of what I'm seeing in the news. And in fact, actually, a great summary from the Center for American Progress over at the Think Progress blog as well. The General Accounting Office, the Government Accounting Office, GAO report. Daily attacks against Iraqs have remained, against Iraqis, have remained unchanged. So, you know, there was a fabulous article in this weekend's New York Times Magazine. I mean, it was truly some brilliant reporting, embedded journalism, talking about how essentially what we've done in Anbar province and those regions in the western part of Iraq that are heavily Sunni is that we've gone into these folks who were killing our soldiers and who have killed many of our soldiers and saying to them, okay, we're just going to turn this over to you guys. You have your own power systems in place. You've got your own structures in place. You've got your tribal chieftains. You've got your hierarchies. We will empower you. And over the short term, it seems to be working quite well, actually, because they don't like the Al-Qaeda bunch. They don't want another Taliban-type government or a fundamentalist-type government. They're not, you know, Iraq has a long history of being a secular Muslim state. And those words, and that is not an oxymoron. And so, you know, they're saying, cool, we'll run this show. Just like down in Basra, the Shiites are running the show. The British pulled out. They said, you guys can run your own country. And so the extent to which this is possible is the extent to which ethnic cleansing has happened. And what we've had is over the last 5 years, there's been this massive amount of ethnic cleansing where people who happen to live in the wrong neighborhoods get murdered. And that's continuing. Between 1 and 2,000 Iraqis dying every single month now. But as a consequence of number one, going along with the ethnic cleansing, and number two, saying to the Iraqis in power, the thugs and the gangs, and frankly, the legitimate historical tribal leaders, I mean, you know, the legitimate in terms of legitimacy in the eyes of their families, their community, saying, okay, you guys are in charge now. That works. But it's got nothing to do with the surge. See, Bush is trying to claim that his surge has helped. And what in fact is happening is a natural, reasonably evolutionary process of, you know, tragically, of ethnic cleansing. I mean, this could have been done without all this bloodshed, without hundreds of thousands of people dying, without thousands of Americans dying and tens of thousands of Americans being. It could have been done without any of that. But, you know, anyhow, they're going to try and make a silk purse out of this sow's ear, I'm telling you, before this. Another story, former Bush official, White House wanted to get rid of that obnoxious FISA court. There's a new book out by Jack Goldsmith. He's a good friend of John Yoo. I heard John Yoo debate at the CPAC conference, the Conservative Political Action Conference that we did our show live from, I think it was in spring of this year. And Bob Barr, the congressman from Georgia who's been on this program a number of times, was debating John Yoo. And Bob Barr is an old-fashioned kind of Barry Goldwater conservative. He calls himself a libertarian nowadays. And John Yoo was the architect of many of the Bush administration's spying policies and whatnot, and war policies. And John Yoo was saying that the government basically should have the absolute right to step on anybody, to throw you in jail. You know, we don't need all these Bill of Rights things. This is, you know, a bunch of nonsense. And so now Jack Goldsmith has written a book saying these guys wanted to get rid of the FISA court. They thought it was a terrible thing and didn't like it. Mr. Draper has a new book out, former Texas Monthly senior editor Robert Draper, and a whole lot of interesting revelations in here. What does George Bush want to do when he grows up, when he leaves office? His great ambition, wealthy boredom. Yes, indeed. This from The Guardian. Jimmy Carter has dedicated his life after the White House to conflict resolution around the world. Bush? Well, he asked Bush, what are you going to do? He says, yeah, I'll give some speeches to replenish the coffers. I don't know what my dad gets. It's more than the $50,000 to $75,000 a speech, and Clinton's making a lot of money. Amazing. In addition, the book reveals that Laura Bush hated Karl Rove. So even though she's still addicted to cigarettes and starting to look like it pretty seriously. My respect for Laura Bush just went up a little bit. And this from another book by Jeffrey Toobin. He's got a new book out. And he's writing in his new book that in the Bush v. Gore case, remember when the Supreme Court stopped the counting of all the votes in Florida, which, had it finished, would have shown that Al Gore actually won Florida and would have awarded the presidency to Florida. The Supreme Court stopped that. It was a 5-4 vote. Souter was one of the four, and he almost quit the court over it. He was shattered by it, was the phrase. David Souter was shattered, at times weeping, when he thought about the case. Toobin writes, for many months it was not clear whether he would remain as a justice. I mean, that's truly mind-boggling. Myrna in Puyallup, Washington. How do you say it, Myrna?
It's Puyallup.
Puyallup. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for letting me speak, because your last guest really pushed a button on me. Because if I understood what he was saying basically there's a certain amount of people that are just going to fall by the wayside anyway. They're poor. They're that's where it's going to be. But what do you
mean? Yeah, to hell with them.
Huh? Yeah, to hell with
them. To hell with them. Yeah.
Yeah. And what he's not getting is that certain amount are students that have graduated college, that have their degrees, that cannot even, the basic thing they can get is a car so they can go to a job, that they can't even get a decent wage. I have, my grandson is in that spot. He is now in Japan for a year teaching English because he can get his medical. He can get his teeth done. He can get double the wages he can get here. Now, that's outrageous. We just send them away. We can discard them.
Yeah. Now, in Rich's defense, since he's not here to defend himself, I don't think that he meant to say, to hell with the poor in this country. What he did say was that there need to be institutions to deal with them, and the government legitimately is one of those institutions. I think where the Thompson campaign and I would find difference, and again, I can't speak for Rich, but I think where any Republican and I would find difference is how much, to what point should the government involve itself in the marketplace and say, the marketplace exists to support the people rather than the marketplace exists to support the wealthy elites. And the Republican position has been since the 70s that the marketplace exists purely and solely to support inherited wealth and corporate power and the elites. And the Democratic position has been that the marketplace exists to support a strong and vibrant middle class and democracy. And those are fundamentally opposition positions. The problem is that when your party takes the position that you're here to support the elites give you a lot of money. And then the Republicans took that money and they forged a coalition with Jerry Falwell and the Moral Majority and brought into the fold a lot of Christians who were willing to make a deal with the devil in exchange for political power and thus were able to get some electoral victories. But the bottom line of Republican politics, in my opinion, is always it's for the rich and powerful, period. And I make the joke, trickle down economics produces a nation of peons. And we've seen it in the last 30 years here in the United States. We saw it back in the 1920s, and we saw it during the age of the robber barons, and we certainly saw it in England. I mean, Rich mentioned Dickens. Dickens' father was thrown into debtor's prison. Dickens knew that firsthand experience. Scott in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Scott.
Yeah. Hi. Two things. One, real quick. I was glad to see you on C-SPAN, but I was disappointed you didn't hold up a photo of Higgins.
We debated bringing Higgins into the studio.
Oh, no,
I was thinking, I Louise and I talked about this, having one of our kids bring Higgins into the studio so that but the problem was we were afraid that he would attack David too unpredictable.
You probably chose correctly, because I know Bruce Williams, the talk show guy, years ago used to have his bulldog Mickey in the studio with him, but I don't think Higgins is as laid back as Mickey was.
No, laid back is not a word you would use
to
describe Higgins.
That's what I mean. Okay, the point of the call, I was really astonished, I think, to hear what your guest, was it Rich Galen, was that his name?
Yeah, Rich Galen, Mullins.com.
I was astonished in a way to hear him basically say we can't gear the program to the lowest members of the society, because I have a sense that, in a sense, that's another way of saying Well, if you're one of the weaker links in the society, if what you've got to live on is good enough for you, you'll just have to make do with it. But I don't think any of them are going to be standing in line to switch places with someone like me or someone, you know, in the lower income brackets.
Yeah, and again, you know, Rich isn't here to defend himself. I'm not sure that's exactly what he meant. But the reality is, and the Republicans have known this for a long time, and they've played on this very successfully, particularly Reagan with his welfare queen story that, by the way, the newspapers challenged him on, and he was unable to find this woman, this supposed welfare queen. Exactly. But the point is that the Republicans for a long, long time have known that by and large the people at the very, very bottom, those who have truly fallen through the cracks, don't vote. And therefore, you know, they can be politically ignored. And the question then becomes, do we as a society envision ourselves as a compassionate people or not? Are we a we society or are we a me society? That's the fundamental cleavage between the conservative and the liberal worldview. The conservatives say we're a me society, and I got mine, and the liberals say we're a we society, and that's what this country was founded on, was the we society.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. Stephanie Miller, Tom Hartman, Randy Rhodes, Jeff Farias, and Mike Malloy. Weekdays on 1480 KPHX. There's no income now. All the wars that were won and lost somehow don't seem to matter very much anymore. All the lies we were told, all the lives of the people running round their castles are burned. Our eyes see change. Inside, we're the same as we ever were.
Yeah, what you're supposed to do is get out there and get active. Create change. Oh, my. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Ellen Ratner on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com, our accredited White House and congressional reporter and all things inside Washington, D.C. What's going on, Ellen?
Well, actually, now we're also accredited United Nations, which we're going to start to cover as well.
Oh, how cool.
Yeah, very, very cool. That just happened last week, so you'll be hearing from us from the United Nations shortly. I think, you know, just when you really can't count on government, they kind of come through for you. The GAO just came through today with a report called Securing, Stabilizing, and Rebuilding Iraq. Iraqi governments, this is the subtitle, has not met most legislative, security, and economic benchmarks. It is 14 pages. David Walker, the controller of the United States, is actually signed off on this report. It says that of the 18 security benchmarks, 3 were partially met, 4 not met. At all, and so that you really have an interesting deal here, where one branch of the government, and this is essentially the accounting branch of the Congress, is saying, right, this is not happening, guys.
Yeah, one of the things I think most Americans don't understand about the GAO is that it is not beholden to anybody. The GAO is. Part of, as you said, the legislative branch. It works for Congress, but it doesn't dance to the tune of Congress. They have about as much independence as any government agency could ever possibly have, and so the president can't go in and say you have to do it this way, and for that matter, the head of the Senate or the House can't go in and say you have to do it this way. Their job is to report the facts. You know, it's Joe Friday, just the facts, ma'am, and that's what they do, and they've been doing it for years.
And they have been doing it for years. And a lot of their reports, for anybody that doesn't know, are available online. You can get a list of them. You can actually even get on their list of reports and have them emailed to you. They're pretty user-friendly that way. And we certainly we like their reports, and they're available for the public. Two other interesting things. There's that book that has been written up everywhere over the weekend, The Terror Presidency. Dead Certain, which has come out today. And that other book, The Terror Presidency, written written by Jack Goldsmith. It's title day today between the GAO, Dead Zertin, and the Terror Presidency. And he essentially is really all over the Bush administration on the FISA court. And yeah. he was at the Justice Department as well. So that's pretty interesting. And then last but not least, well, I could go on for a hundred other things, but today Mitch McConnell had a little press conference, and he said that Larry Craig and David Vitter were very different, because what happened with David Vitter was alleged to have happened, or he admitted to it happening, before he got to Congress. I wonder if you murder somebody, if it happens before you get to Congress, if it doesn't matter. And therefore, he doubts whether the Ethics Committee would have jurisdiction over it. And I'm sorry, not Congress, but before he got to the Senate, because he was
at he was in the House of Representatives at the time,
right,
wasn't he?
Exactly.
So he was in Congress.
Right.
Yeah.
But he wasn't in the Senate. And he doubted whether that they would have jurisdiction. And then he said that ethics issues with Senate Republicans would be dealt with on a case-by-case basis. And I also don't know if you heard the interview this morning with the children of Larry Craig.
No.
But it was on Diane Sawyer. And he basically, it was either this last night or this morning, I heard the whole interview. And, I mean, they just say their dad is the most reasonable dad. This is all just groundless.
Yeah. Well, you know, he may well be. And you know, ultimately, I'm inclined at a certain level to say, so what? I'm more, although he did plead guilty, which makes it very strange. But the big issue here is that, you know, the difference between Vitter and Craig, other than the fact that it was straight versus gay, which I think is one of the big issues for a lot of Republicans, a lot of so-called cultural Republicans, is who's the governor of the states.
It'd be all over.
Yeah. Well, maybe. Because Vitter is from a state where there's a Democratic governor who would replace Vitter with a Democrat. And Vitter's a Republican. And that would further solidify the Democratic control of the United States Senate. And the Republican Party is not going to take a chance on that happening. I have a feeling David Vitter could have been found, you know, fill in the blank of some horrific thing.
Well,
and he'd still be in the
on
Senate.
On one hand, but I think the Republican Party is so homophobic that they'd even hurt themselves in terms of elections because of that. Because
I think they'd censure him. I don't think that they'd ask for him to leave.
Okay, we don't know.
I may be wrong, these guys are. I mean, what we have seen is that in the Republican Party, politics, the political equation, always is at the top of the pile, and you know, things like integrity and consistency are always subordinate to that.
Well, I think that you're right, although I think, again, I mean, some of these guys are complete lunatic homophobes, like I have never seen anything in my life down here. And you can't even mention it to them, and they just go bananas. And it's interesting, Frank Kameny, a gay activist, ran for Congress in 1980, was kicked out of the State Department for being homosexual, et cetera, said he should sue for false arrest.
Larry Craig.
Yeah.
Yeah, he absolutely should. If he's, you know, if it was a false arrest, he should sue for it. Absolutely. But I don't think he wants to open that can of worms. we'll see where it goes. Anyhow, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
At what point do we begin to say, as a nation, collectively, at what point do we say, we're not afraid anymore? You know, we started this program 2 hours, well, actually exactly 2 hours ago. We're in the third hour of the program now. Started the program 2 hours ago talking about the infantilism of America, the immaturity of America. And I would like to submit to you that the ultimate way to keep people immature is to keep them afraid. that when people are afraid, they can't think rationally. They can't participate in rational or intelligent dialogue. They can't think of the big picture. They can't. I mean, it's just beyond their capability. This is, you know, Psych 101. This is common sense. When people are afraid, their ability to reason goes out the window. And the Bush administration, for seven years now, has done absolutely everything they can to keep us as afraid as possible, and the media have been going right along with it because fear sells. Here's an example of how the Democrats have been made afraid. Dan Frazier is an activist in Flagstaff, Arizona, and he put together a T-shirt, right? Just made a T-shirt with the names of several thousand, 3,000 dead U.S. war troops, and the names are public record. I mean, you can find them anywhere. And so he put 3,000 names on there, very small type, and you know it's on a black T-shirt. And some of them, and the names are in white, you know, reversed out of the black. And over some of them, he has reversed out of red instead of reversed out of black in a way that the type that when you look at it from 5 feet away, it says Bush lied in red on a black T-shirt. And then when you look closely, you see that it's all made out of names. So it's Bush lied, and these are the people who died. The Arizona legislature, in response to this, the Republicans got all in a snit. How dare you say that Bush lied and these people died? And so they passed a bill in Arizona that said that it was against the law to use the names of dead troops or likenesses of dead soldiers to sell goods. Now, the First Amendment of the Constitution protects free speech, but it particularly protects political free speech. And if this is not an example of political free speech, I don't know what is. This is the ultimate protected by the First Amendment statement. Bush lied and these people died. The vote in the Arizona legislature to make this T-shirt illegal was 28-0. All the Republicans voted for it. All the Democrats voted for it. When they were contacted later, several of the Democrats had second thoughts. This from Reason Magazine, October 2007 issue. House Minority Leader Phil Lopez, a Democrat from Tucson, called his vote a senior moment. Representative Tom Przelski, the Democrat from Tucson, confessed he'd failed to read the final version of the bill. And Representative Kirsten Semina, the Democrat from Phoenix, admitted she hadn't read any version of the bill despite voting for it twice. The ACLU, as you may expect, is taking this thing to court. But it's not just Arizona that's passed laws like this. Oklahoma and Louisiana have also passed laws like this, and Texas is considering one. Why? Because we're afraid. We're setting aside the First Amendment because we're afraid. It's time to stop being afraid. Tobacco kills 500,000 people, more or less, in this country every year. Terrorists in the United States, in the last 8 years, have killed 3,000-plus people. If you include Christian terrorists like Tim McVeigh and the guy who did the bombing down in Atlanta, and then the people who have murdered a few abortion doctors. I mean, if you take all terrorism in the United States over the last, 100 years, include the Ku Klux Klan terrorism against African Americans, include the terrorism against the civil rights activists, both white and black, in the 1960s. If you add it all up, it's fewer people than die from tobacco in this country in a month or two. At what point do we join the rest of the civilized world You know, Germany had the Bader Meinhof gang, you know, local terrorist group. Italy had the Red Brigades. In fact, one of the Red Brigades is getting out of prison this month. There's a story about it in the paper last week. We even went through this. We had the Symbionese Liberation Army kidnap Patty Hearst. I mean, did we as a nation become terrified? England fought the IRA for years and years. The IRA actually had some very legitimate grievances. That's a whole other discussion. But the fact of the matter is that it was perceived by the British people as terrorism. I was down in Bogota, Colombia when the drug wars were going on. I remember one day we were driving down the street and a bomb went off about six blocks away, blew the front of a store away. Did the people of Bogota all of a sudden begin trembling? No. At what point do we say, we're not going to be afraid? I'm sorry, George, you can't terrify us anymore. Fear is no longer going to work in this country. We're going to go back to listening to Franklin Roosevelt.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
And he was talking about the Great Depression, which was a time of fear. And when you set aside fear, you can get things done. And here's the amazing thing. Hillary Clinton the other day made this comment, for which she has been roundly criticized by all the right-wingers, that if there was a terror attack, it would accrue benefit to the Republicans. And it is true in as much as if there was a terror attack in the United States, the media would use it to further scare us, and the Republicans would use it to further scare us. And there are not a lot of Democrats who have the courage to stand up and say, you know, they struck us, they hurt us, and I'm not afraid. Life is full of risks. 50,000 people this year are going to die on our highways, half of them as a consequence of drunk drivers. I'm not going to be afraid to drive. 400,000 or 500,000 people this year are going to die from tobacco. A significant percentage of them, perhaps as many as 20% of them, secondhand smoke. That doesn't mean that when I walk into a bar where somebody's smoking, I'm going to start trembling. I mean, you know, I look at risks in a reasonable fashion. I smoked myself from the time I was around 14 or 15 years old until Louise became pregnant with our oldest child when I was 22, I think. And both Louise and I, we both smoked from the time we were teenagers until she became pregnant. And then we both quit and said, you know, this is not a reasonable equation here. But at a certain level, you say, you know, it wasn't about fear. It was about being reasonable. This whole security meme, we need to break this thing down. And we need to say to the Republican Party and the few terrified Democrats like Joe Lieberman, the pitiful, wimpy, terrified Democrats. I realize Joe Lieberman's an independent, but nonetheless, we need to say to them, we're not afraid anymore, and go peddle your damn fear someplace else. Because we're America. We have been through hell in this country, and we've come through it. In the War of 1812, they burned down the White House, the Canadians and the British, and we made it through. In the Civil War, we had one of the bloodiest wars in the history of the world, certainly of that era, and we got through it. We fought World War I. We fought World War II. We're not afraid. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Richard Green, the host of Clout, program that was on weekends on Air America starting this week now, Monday through Friday. Check your local time and station and all that sort of thing, as they say in the radio and television business. A former attorney and political communications speech strategist, Richard is the author of Words That Shook the World, 100 Years of Unforgettable Speeches and Events. And, Richard, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. It sounds like a rock and roll revival here. That's, I didn't know you were a DJ.
Actually, I was for years.
Were you? On top of what, 800 other things that you've done in your life?
That's how I started in radio. Yeah, I was 17 years old, and my first job was, not my first job, but my first job in radio was as a DJ, and I did that for 3 years. I did news for 7 years, and I was a program director for a year. But anyway, that was long ago and far away. First of all, just a very quick question. Cloud. What is cloud?
Cloud is do something radio. You know, at Air America, we've got people like Tom Hartman, you may have heard of him, Randy Rhodes, and Lionel, and even in other networks, these amazing political thinkers. And our show is about doing something with all of that information that you create for people to play with in their heads. And what we're doing is we're actually creating a clout force. And we're going to have people contacting Congress people and senators all over the country on every single important issue that we talk about, that you guys talk about, and hold them accountable for their votes, because a lot of this goes underneath the radar and no one knows. Yeah, we believe in this, and then they don't vote the right way. So we're
Are you building a website around this or something?
It's going to be interactive with the website. We're going to have people actually delivering mail to congressional offices, and we're going to have representatives in each political in each congressional district, where someone from that district who is a clout listener will be actually holding them accountable for their vote, and in fact doing roll call in advance, so we know who it is that we need to lobby. So that's just one aspect of it, but it's about. And we have Harry Reid on our show today. It's about actually making a difference, both politically and also marketplace cloud, because we're premiering something later this week which is called Green Cloud, which is the fact that, and Leonardo DiCaprio said this to you in your interview on the 11th hour, we vote with our dollars every single day, and we need to maximize that. So we're going to have the most eco-friendly, ecopreneur-filled, triple-bottom-line companies with the greatest products, so that the Procter & Gambles and Johnsons of the world are going to have to do things the right way and stop polluting America.
Well, I think actually a lot of them are moving in that direction, and that's a fine thing. Green is the new green. You know, no pun intended, your name being Richard Green, but green is the, you know, as in money, green. Green is the new way that people can make money.
And nothing, by the way, nothing speaks louder.
Right. And as a speech strategist and political communications consultant, you had some suggestions on what could have saved Larry Craig's career.
Well, it was funny. Over the weekend, and I was away from the Internet for a few minutes, and I woke up and I said, you know what? Oh, my God. Just like Nixon could have saved his career by being contrite and coming out about Watergate, and Clinton could have saved his impeachment if he had been contrite and come out with the right kind of speech, and said, oh, my God, what an amazing opportunity for Larry Craig to not be a pariah and to go into disgrace, into the wilderness for the rest of his life, but to be a real hero. And so I started penciling out a speech, and as soon as I got to a phone, I was going to call his press secretary and say, listen, I'm a Democrat. I host a show on Air America, but this is a golden opportunity for this guy to be a hero and to do what the 14th Amendment basically talks about, which is allow there to be equality in America. And the homosexual anti-gay movement is the last, I think, vestige of our hatred in this country against...
You mean the homophobic anti-gay movement?
The belief, the hatred against homosexuals, the prejudice against homosexuals is, in fact, equivalent to where we were, you know, back in Lincoln's days. So I penciled out a speech, and the speech that he gave, or the statement he gave, was 180 degrees from that. And the speech is, I am a gay American, and I've suffered greatly as I tried to hide that fact from those I love and those I represent. I reject the policies that force so many to hide the truth of who they are, and those policies forced him into that bathroom in Minneapolis. I will continue to serve the people of Idaho and will run for re-election next year. If the great people of Idaho, in their wisdom, do not want a gay senator, then I will accept their verdict. And until then, I will do what was my oath as a senator and everything I can to uphold the Constitution, especially the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution, which mandates equal treatment for all. America is a great nation, and it is time that we put this hatred of our fellow citizens behind us. And I believe that had he given that, he would still be a senator. He would be hated by the religious right, but celebrated by everybody else.
I respectfully.
We disagree every time we talk.
I think the Republican Party still would have thrown him out on his butt.
But
and I think that it's really important that we differentiate between the fact that he may or may not have been gay and the fact that he was hustling in a restroom. Because hustling in a restroom is something that, whether you're gay or straight, just shouldn't be happening. I mean, you know, there's kids who go into those restrooms, things like that. And I think that it perpetuates a real negative stereotype of gays that by and large is not real.
I understand, but what about David Vitter? I mean, was that a legal thing for him to be doing?
Oh, yeah, no, Vitter, obviously, he broke the laws of Washington, D.C., but see, Vitter
is... And that's
a
continuation of that homophobic double standard, and we can't have
that. Yeah, well, and Vitter's from a state where the governor is a Democrat and would appoint a Democrat to replace him.
I understand the politics of it.
I think that's a huge piece of it.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Richard, you're welcome. Richard Green, the host of Clout on Air America Radio, 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. Stephanie Miller at 6 a.m. Tom Hartman at 9 a.m. Weekday morning on the Valley's Progressive Talk, 1480 KPHX.
Emma drops me a note here, an email. She says, don't forget the terrorists who stormed Congress in the 1950s, the PR terrorists. Let's not forget the terrorists like Joe McCarthy, the guy who tried to sell us terror.
Oh, be afraid of the Soviet Union. Be very afraid. Be very afraid.
And it's, no. You know, there were a lot of us back, a lot of people back in the, I bought into the fear up until probably 1966 or 67. There are a lot of Americans who, and at the same time, there are a lot of Americans who said, no. We're going to make rational decisions. We're going to try to pursue rational foreign policy. We're going to make right decisions, but we're not going to be afraid. In fact, Aaron sends me a note. He says, if we are afraid of terrorism, then the terrorists win. You're absolutely right. That's the whole point of it. So every time Bush goes on TV and says, oh, we need to be afraid of these guys. And every time Dick Cheney says, you know, if you vote for the Democrats, they're going to hit us again. Every time the Republican Party and a few of the terrified Democrats use terror as an excuse to do anything. Osama bin Laden is chuckling. I'm personally not going to give him. I'm not going to give him that. Brian in Redondo Beach, California. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind today?
A whole lot. You know, and I will never give in either, and we shouldn't be afraid. But Tom, I was sitting here listening to you. I was listening to you earlier, and I forgot about the truckers going to start rolling across the country.
Right.
And I thought to myself, I know because we have ourselves such a great president, and I know that the Republican Party is so good on security, I know there's scanners there that's going to scan every single one of those trucks. And you asked earlier, would don't be afraid? Don't be afraid to write a letter, because while I was waiting, I already got my letter ready to go to Congress and ask them those same very questions.
Yeah.
My other thing is?
But it goes beyond that, Brian, frankly, in my opinion. I think that this is really, this whole thing of allowing Mexican truckers into the United States. I mean, there's people who are trying to play the fear thing. You know, one of them might be a secret terrorist. There are people who are saying, well, you know, the trucks might not be all that good or that well run or whatever.
Right.
I mean, in this test thing that is starting. And by the way, keep in mind, the Democrats in Congress actually blocked this.
Okay.
And Bush put through this test by executive order, I believe. I may be wrong,
right,
but
I'm
pretty sure.
Let me say this real quick. I don't want to cut you off, but I know your time is fast.
No, that's okay. You wanted to say something.
Like they say, the Mexicans are taking the jobs that Americans won't do.
Well, that's the bottom line.
Here, sir, is a job that there are Americans who will want to do this job, who are truckers, who are sitting at home wanting a job. And you know what I thought about while I was sitting there waiting? Back in the 70s, when everybody had that keep on trucking, remember that?
Yeah.
Everybody loved that sticker, and those our truckers were our truckers, and were the ones who delivered our food. They got our chickens to it in a fast enough time. We didn't have to have that many pesticides and all that growth hormone and stuff. So I have a suggestion. What can we do? I suggest that all the truckers go down to the border and block it and don't let nobody come in. And then again, what are the Minutemen going to do about this?
Yeah. The problem with having all the truckers go down there and block the border is, once again, the independent truckers in the United States are almost all gone, and the trucking companies have broken most of the union. I mean, the Teamsters is still out there, but it's just the power of unions in America, because we've had 26 years now of the Labor Department being an anti-labor institution. The power of unions in the United States has been destroyed, and Brian, you make an excellent point. And boy, would I love to see some direct action out there. I mean, boy, would I love to see it. And it is so hard. You had, just for example, there was a piece on Common Dreams over the weekend talking about how Al Gore had come out and said, I can't understand why we don't have students, you know, forming rings around coal-fired power plants that they're building. I mean, these things are going to destroy the world in which they are going to live. And the answer is really simple. You have students who are so terrified. Again, there's that fear. And this is, I mean, Alan Greenspan said it in the Wall Street Journal. I write about it in my book, Screwed. Alan Greenspan said, you know, his job as head of the Fed is to maintain a certain level of worker insecurity so there won't be labor unrest. I mean, the whole bottom line is keep the workers terrified. And you've got students who are terrified. I mean, they worked all through junior high school and high school to get just into that college. And they're going to take a chance on getting kicked out. Plus, if they get kicked out, they've got $20,000, $30,000 in student loans that they've got to pay off, and now they don't even have a degree. They're terrified. We are being terrorized by huge multinational interests and by a military-industrial complex which is aligned with the media in this country. And damn it, we should just stop being afraid. And take this country back and say, we know how to make a society work. We have done it before. And that prosperity of the 60s that our guest in the very first hour of this program said led to the immaturity of America. I'm sorry, it wasn't prosperity that led to it. It was the corporate advertising industry. David in New York City. Hey, David. You're on the air, David. I guess David's not on the air. Elizabeth in Queens, New York. Hey, Elizabeth.
Oh, hello. I wanted to give the quote from J.P. Morgan on a living wage, and this is relative to the viewpoint expressed by the senior advisor to Fred Thompson. Mm-hmm. And this is from the Cry for Justice edited and published by Upton Sinclair. Before 1915, an anthology of literature of social protest. American banker, J.P. Morgan. Testimony before the United States Commission on Industrial Relations. Question, do you consider $10 a week enough for a longshoreman with a family to support? Answer, if that's all he can get and he takes it, I should say it's enough.
Yeah.
That's all I have to say.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. What you're demonstrating is what David Ricardo in 1817, as I recall, in his paper booklet, whatever you want to call it, on labor, called the Iron Law of Wages. And basically what he said is that in an absolutely unregulated economy, you will not have a middle class, you will have the working poor, because that is what it will produce. And the only way that you can produce a middle class is to allow labor to have equal power with corporate interests, which means things like unions. And there are the three main devices that the conservatives have used to break the power of labor, to break the back of labor, and thus destroy the American middle class. And they've done it because the American middle class was a pesky thing back in the 1960s. The middle class was saying, hey, we want equality. We want decent wages. We want benefits. People were going on strike. I mean, you know, this is terrible stuff. And they didn't vote for Republicans. I mean, you know, Lyndon Johnson, the Great Society, ending poverty in the United States, the war on poverty, ending racism and the institutional racism anyway in the United States. I mean, this is terrible stuff from the point of view of the conservatives. And so the tools that they used are very simple. Flood the market with cheap labor. Reagan's amnesty, number one. Number two, where you can't, where labor refuses to be cheap, like in Flint, Michigan. where the workers in the General Motors factories said, you know, you're going to pay us a decent wage or we're going to refuse to work. Take those jobs out of the United States, and GM goes down to Mexico and builds five factories as they shut down five factories in Flint and wipe out the town. And number three, change the Labor Department from an agency that is enforcing the Wagner Act. You realize it's illegal right now. Under the law in the United States, if you're fired for union activity, you are supposed to be able to be compensated for the loss of wages from your job, and if you take a new job, you're supposed to be paid the difference between what you made in your old job and what you're making in your new job. That law has not been enforced since the 1980s. And as a consequence of that, over 30,000 people a year are fired for engaging in union organizing in the United States. I mean, it's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, I was really calling about fabric softener and how many of us, including myself, have suffered badly from that. But while I was on hold, I remembered there's a very critical vote this week that probably the biggest vote on elections we've had in a long time. And I need to urge everyone to call their congressperson, also vote on MoveOn.org to not support H.R. 811, Rush Holt's bill.
Yeah, this is the old Rush Holt bill that, according to Brad Blog, last week Rush Holt said it's not his bill anymore because Microsoft got in there and lobbied and altered it.
Yeah, well, it may be voted on tomorrow, and the thing is, it's most of the people don't understand it at all, and it will.
Right. It'll institutionalize electronic voting machine.
Yeah, and we've got to stop electronic voting machines. And again, we're fighting the Democrats this year rather than the Republicans.
I know.
The Democrats are doing a much worse job.
But, no, I absolutely agree with you. Call 202-225-3121 and ask for your member of the House of Representatives and say vote no on Rush Holt's Bill 811.
And MoveOn.org has a vote of whether they should support it. So if you're a MoveOn member, vote no today. Not tomorrow, but today.
Yeah, for sure.
Can I talk about the fabric softener?
Yeah, I am so allergic to fabric softeners that if there's any in my clothes, it burns my skin. It actually burns my skin. It turns red.
Well, about a year ago, I noticed there is a smell emerging that I could barely stand. My next-door neighbor, when I had the windows open, had switched fabric softeners, and I had to close my windows.
I think there's some serious chemicals in our environment. This goes back to what we were talking about an hour ago.
I got really bad headaches. As soon as she got her to stop and as soon as the laundromat on the corner closed, my headaches, my neck aches, and everything went down to zero.
Yeah.
I spent a month with really horrible headaches last year.
Look
up fabric softener and health on the web.
Okay, great. Thank you, Jeff. And this is why we need government organizations that, look at these things and protect us from these things, because we can't all be fully informed about everything.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio. Randy Rhodes at noon, Jeff Farias at 3. Weekday afternoons on the Valley's Progressive Talk, 1480 KPHX.
Now, what do we do next? I just can't seem to figure it out.
Bomb, 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 bomberan.
Bomb, 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 bomberan.
Bomb, 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 bomb,
I am telling you, we've been predicting this for some time. It's probably starting today, at the very least starting this week. We are in all probability going to see the launch of a major PR campaign, a major PR blitz in the United States about Iran. Iran is the new enemy. Iran is the new thing to be afraid of. And therefore, let's let the military-industrial complex in this country make a few more hundreds of billions of dollars by bombing Iran. It's coming. I'm telling you, it is coming. Jake in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Jake, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I got a few points. You seem to have a cordial relationship with Galen, who's working for Thompson.
I try not to be a jerk. I don't know Rich Galen.
I believe that our side in general, in the main, tries not to be a jerk. Yeah. Now, Lunson Gingrich came up in the 60s with propagandistic terms to be used for and against the other side, the opposition, we Democrats and liberals and what the heck is... secular progressive.
Gingrich had his whole word list, yeah.
You know. Yeah. Galen was acting as though it were his show and you were one of those boorish right-wingers and he talked right over you.
Well... I don't know. I'm not sure how loud you can hear me in your headphones or on your telephone there. It may well be that he just happens all the time.
No. Plus he used a number of terms which are dismissive. He's following the Fred Barnes playbook, which is to use derisive laughter, right, and use terms like absurdity.
That's what people do when they don't have an argument. I mean, you know, I think that for the listeners of this show, Jake, people get it that when people don't have an argument, that they fall back on you know, making fun of people or trying to make a joke or trying to change the subject. And not to say that Rich did or didn't do that. Again, he's not here to defend himself. But it doesn't concern me so much, frankly. Barbara in Minnesota. Hey, Barbara, welcome to the program.
Hi. I wanted to talk about the Larry Craig debacle, and I would assume that, frankly, Bush wanted to get rid of him rather than their great upset about the homosexuality. Craig had joined in with the Democrats in opposing the making permanent all of the Patriot Act, and he has been supported Bob Barr and some of the things about the excesses of the...
Oh, really? Now, see, I didn't know that. I frankly have not paid that much attention to Larry Craig's past politics because, you know, just everything else is eclipsed by the measurements. But that's interesting. So Larry Craig is perceived by the Bush administration as the enemy.
Supposedly Bush has called him a traitor with a few expletives in front, and told the senatorial committee to start looking for a replacement for Craig.
Very, very interesting. Before the bathroom incident. That's fascinating. Thank you for sharing that with us, Barbara. Scott in Springfield, Illinois. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Tom. Was actually going to talk about the thing down in Alabama where they put the Democrat in jail just before the election, but I wanted to...
Don Siegelman, the governor.
I've been watching C-SPAN 3 here on the GAO report, and they did modify it. The 2 points were modified by the White House. One, the guy said he was thinking of modifying himself. The other, he said the White House gave him information. But it's still only an 18% grade. They only passed three. The other there was four more that made partial progress and failed 11. 70% is usually an F grade.
Yeah.
I mean, this is beyond morons. I mean, idiots score better on tests than 18%.
Yeah.
I mean,
not to use the clinical term, but your point is made, Scott. Over at Huffington Post, the top story: top Cheney aide, we're one bomb away from getting rid of the wiretap court. Dick Cheney praying for an attack on the United States, so he can get rid of any court oversight over the wiretapping of what? Ted Kennedy? I'm telling you, I guarantee you, I guarantee you. If the Republican Party was operating out of the office of the senator from Utah, out of Orrin Hatch's office, they were for a year and a half they had hacked into Ted Kennedy's computer and they were reading his emails. I guarantee you George Bush is listening to him on the telephone. It's that simple. David in New York City. Hey, David.
Hey, Tom. Thank you very much for your very knowledgeable and progressive point of view and your attack on deception. Tom, I wonder if you're aware that on Sunday, September 2nd, the New York Times ran a first-page article questioning whether 9/11 is fading. And I wonder if you're aware that there's a major conference at Cooper Union in New York on Saturday the 8th and the 9th on 7th Street and 3rd Avenue that's going to tackle the hard facts about 9/11 and really provide the scientific evidence that questions the official version of 9/11.
Well, I was unaware of that, David, but I am now, and so are our listeners. So thanks for calling and getting it out there. It's 56 minutes. Well, it's the end of the third hour of the program. Coming up Wednesday on the Tom Hartman program, I'll be asking conservative John Armour, why shouldn't American rights apply to those in American custody? Everything You Know Is Wrong, Simon Connie Bennett is here on the secret side of sugar. Larry Scott on Veterans Affairs, plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program, your radio support group for We the People. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.